Hello and welcome to another episode of Engine Nerds. This is a monthly podcast coming to you from Northumbria University in Newcastle. And this episode is being recorded live in front of a live audience. The podcast is about all things to do with engineering. And I'm sat here with Craig Boren and Madeline Conbrink. My name's Nick Martin, and usually I do that in the other order, but that's what happens when you record a podcast live. This week, we've got three interesting things to do with engineering that we're going to talk about. And the first thing we're going to talk about this week is my kind of interesting thing for this month. And that is that there are some trains that have lasers attached to their heads.
This does sound like the title for like a bad movie or something, you know.
There is actually something mentioned about a TV series from the 70s called Supertrain. And I followed the link from it, and it is interesting to watch.
Yeah, so I think I saw that as well on the article, and it was some weird like 70s kind of... Is it like a sitcom or something? I don't know. I watched the intro credits and then didn't want to watch anymore. It was really weird.
That's why I used the word interesting. I meant it in the English way.
So this fact is about a Dutch company called Netherlands Spoorwegen, and you're going to have to correct me on that pronunciation. And basically, they used a high-powered laser to blast leaves off of tracks to stop trains from getting delayed. And so in the UK, on average every year, I think 5.4 million passenger hours are lost every year because of leaves on the track.
I'm having a hard time kind of visualizing how leaves can be so much of a problem. You know, I have this image in my head of this sort of floaty leaf floating down onto a rail track and somehow bringing a train to halt. How is that possible?
It is weird. So, I mean, you think about it, don't you? Like when I'm like sitting at the station and like the tannoy comes on, it's like your train has been delayed because leaves are on the track. You just think, how on earth can a leaf stop like how many ton train? I was doing a bit of reading about this, and so it turns out that it's actually kind of to do with a little bit like jam.
Okay.
And a little bit like razor blades. There's some like correlation there. Mm-hmm. So basically what happens is, so leaves fall on the track and then a train comes along and like crushes them up into like little leaf dusty stuff. Mm-hmm. Then it rains and that kind of turns into like squidgy kind of stuff. And the leaves have pectin in them, which is the same stuff that turns fruit juice into kind of jam, jelly-like substance. And so that's basically what happens. The leaves turn into a kind of jelly leaf jam type thing. And then they react with the surface of the train track and it adheres it to it, so it kind of sticks to it. And then, you know, maybe they'll dry out and it stops raining and the trains are going over and everything's fine. And at that point, it's kind of a little bit like the kind of, you know, the strip on your razor that kind of is quite rough, like normally. And then as soon as it gets wet, it becomes like the most slippiest thing known to man.
Okay, yeah. So this is what happens to the leaves on the rail then.
That's what happens to this kind of leaf jam stuff that's like on the rails. It becomes super slippy and then basically the trains can't stop.
So kind of it reduces the friction.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. Okay, so and presumably they just reduce the speeds of the trains to kind of compensate for this hazard, or?
Yeah, or they have to stop them altogether. Which is why you get the delays, yeah.
And how do we deal with that at the moment? If we don't have a laser.
If you don't have a laser, traditionally there's a few things you can do. So you can use high-powered water to like kind of blast it off. That doesn't work very well. Sometimes they use sand to like sprinkle on the tracks to try and kind of abrade it off. Or if you're like this Dutch company, you use a high-powered laser.
Yeah, and I kind of had in my mind that I assumed, maybe naively, that there was maybe some kind of cleaning train that sort of went along and did this job. But it turns out that the jet washing solution is fitted to almost every train that runs regularly, so it's constantly kind of removing this
leaf
this jam.
Yeah.
Your fact does explain something to me. I was looking for the most ridiculous reasons I could find why trains are delayed. And there's quite a list, and there's a documentary series about it. In 2011, Channel 4 brought out Train Journeys from Hell.
Okay.
And from that, they extracted a list of ridiculous reasons for delays. And one of them was slippery trains.
Slippery trains?
Yes. So the train was delayed because it's slippery.
And was this slipperiness due to leaves? Or?
They did not say, but it makes a lot of sense in that regard. But I found a couple of others that was quite fun as well. So in the 1940s, some of the locomotives were late. And the reason it was given is the wrong type of coal has been delivered.
Okay, yeah.
Hence they can't drive the train. And then
I didn't realize there were different types of coal for trains. that's a new one to me.
There's definitely different grades of coal.
Right.
I know that.
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe something for a future podcast.
Yeah.
different types of coal. But then in Burnley Station, there was an announcement that the train that is arriving on platform one is on fire. And passengers are advised not to board this train.
Good advice, yeah.
Then in Cardiff, from them came, the train is delayed because there's a giant clown on the line.
Right.
And what happened is there was a McDonald's restaurant near the train tracks, and there was a giant Ronald McDonald, or blow-up Ronald McDonald, on the roof of it, and it blew off the roof and onto the train tracks.
Brilliant.
And the best one I didn't get from the internet, I got from a friend in London. And he said to me that his train was once delayed and the announcement was as follows. Ladies and gentlemen, this train will be delayed until further notice. The train driver has locked himself into the bathroom and he refuses to come out.
Fair enough. So bring it back to engineering. So
well, we don't often do this.
No. So the lasers they were using on the train, so they're called ND-YAG lasers, which is actually the same kind of laser that I use in some of the research that I do. So it turns out that the same laser that you can use to blast leaf jam off of tracks is the same laser that you can use to measure flow velocities around a car, which is the same laser actually that you can use if you want to go and get kind of beauty therapy and have like your blemishes removed. So lots of multi-use laser, this one. Obviously, you don't use the same power on your face than you would.
Yeah, slightly scared by the fact that you can kind of, you know, disintegrate leaves and use the same thing on your skin. Yeah. Please explain.
What is the safety regulations for these lasers?
Well, that's a good question, actually. So the Dutch company claims that it's completely safe for animals and humans. But I don't actually fully understand how, because it's an ND-YAG laser, which basically means, so that stands for neodymium doped yttrium aluminium garnet laser, and so it's a 2 kilowatt laser, and it's an infrared laser, which is like the most dangerous kind of laser, because basically if someone points a laser at you and it's like a visible light laser, then your natural response for your eye is to kind of close, you know, fairly quickly. And so the damage that you can do is fairly limited, unless it's like a stupidly powerful laser. But an infrared laser is invisible to the human eye. So if someone shines an infrared laser in your eye, then, you know, it's not going to be good. You'll probably go blind and you won't know it until you can't see anymore. So I honestly don't know how they must put like a case around it or something.
Some kind of shield or something.
Because they're basically shining a pretty strong laser at a shiny surface, which would then radiate it back out. I don't know. It seems pretty dangerous to me. But they've obviously got some kind of solution. Yeah.
Want to know what the most powerful laser in the world is?
Yes.
So your one was 2 kilowatts?
2 kilowatts, yeah.
Apparently the most powerful one in the world is 2 petawatts. So
right.
two times 10 to the 15 watts.
You don't want to take that in the eye.
Yeah, that's not going to be good for your eye. not so portable. It's 100 meters long.
Okay, yeah, you can't fit that on a train.
Nope, so this...
or a shark.
This is at the University of Osaka in Japan, and they're using it for something that they call fast ignition experiments. You can kind of see how it's probably going to happen pretty fast with that amount of power.
Yeah.
To recreate the extreme environments found in space.
Like stars, basically.
Yeah. And it could also lead us on to talking about plasma, but I think we might want to save that exciting subject.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in another podcast.
Yeah.
Plasma's my new favourite thing.
Yes, indeed.
There's an interesting story behind yttrium, which is one of the metals that is used to create the crystal for this laser. So yttrium was discovered on an island just off the one of the archipelagos in Sweden, mm-hmm. A small island called Yttaby, and there was a mine down there. And back in like 17 something or other, they discovered some minerals down there. And in this one mine, they've discovered not only yttrium, but erbium, terbium, and ytterbium, all in this one place. And it's like kind of the most...
it's got the record. Island in Sweden.
It's like got the record for like the most elements found in one place.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. Do you want to hear some more train delay facts before we end this segment?
Yeah, go for it.
So, we like to complain about train delays in the UK.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, let's look to see across Europe. You know, what country would you think would have the least train delays in Europe?
Germany.
Fairly close.
Switzerland?
More renowned for their timekeeping, Switzerland. So, apparently... Around about 90% of trains in Switzerland run on time. 88% of trains in the UK run on time. So you think, actually, that's not too bad. But then you dig a bit deeper and you find that in Switzerland, a train is considered to be on time if it's less than 3 minutes late. However, in the UK, that figure jumps to 10 minutes and even longer, depending on the length of journey that the train is taking. So... we still have a ways to go, I think.
Yeah. it reminds me of a saying we have in experimentation, is to measure is to know, but then you must know what you have measured.
Yeah.
Okay, so has anyone got anything else to add?
We have the flying trains. Do you want to go along that route?
Flying trains. Well, I mean, flying trains would obviously get around the leaf jam problem, I suppose. So what's a flying train?
Ah, the flying train. So that is... one of the new concepts that is still in development.
Definitely concept stages, I would
definitely
say.
Definitely concept stages. It's a very low technology in this level. And the whole idea is to... it's not a train that literally flies through the air, but the idea is to attach wings to normal conventional trains and have them hover above the stations and from one area to another, instead of having to deal with the undercarriage and the weight and that comes with that.
They don't travel on a track then, they fly like a kind of an aeroplane?
They fly like an aeroplane, but the concept is that it will be a low-flying train.
Okay.
Sounds incredibly dangerous.
That's why it's a concept, not a fully developed idea yet.
So our next fact, I think that's your fact this week.
So going in from things that flying.
Yeah.
So my fact this week is that NASA is testing a new alloy to enable them to fold aircraft wings during flight.
Okay, sounds good. Why would they want to do that? Why would they want to fold?
Okay, so the technology of a folding wing is certainly no new concept.
Okay.
Just not in flight. So normally what would happen is, in order to store, if you have a limited storage space, you will be able to, with some aircraft, to fold up the wings so that you can place them in the hangar. This you use especially on aircraft carriers where your space is extremely limited.
Right.
But during no time in that process is the aircraft actually in flight. But what NASA is doing at the Armstrong Flight Research Center is they are experimenting with spanwise adaptive wings. And the idea is that during flight, you want the optimal flight conditions for your wings so that you can minimize drag and maximize lift. And for that, you want to fold the tips of the wings.
Right.
Yes. Like, so you want to be able to fold them at different angles
for
optimal conditions.
For those people at home listening, Madeline is kind of just
waving her hands
around up and down. Okay.
And we never do that during podcasts either.
So you want different conditions, presumably, for like takeoff and landing versus normal flight.
You want to be able, yes, for different conditions, but it depends on the air conditions that you have during flight, at what velocity you are flying, what altitude. So they want to be able to have control of the wings during flight. Now, this is not a new concept because it's been tested ever since the 60s. They started off with the XB-70 Valkyrie, but for them it was a very conventional method where they would use heavy motors, actuators, and hydraulics to be able to control the motion. But what they are testing here is they are doing it with shape memory alloy.
Right. So they're the kind of metals that you apply a certain temperature to it and it changes the crystal structure, is that right, of the metal, and that deforms?
So that alloy is, it's literally what it says. It has a memory. And it can change its crystalline structure from martensite to
is it austenite?
Austenite, yeah. Depending on what type of heat it is exposed to or cooling.
Mm. I can never remember which way around it is. I think is it the austenite which is like kind of more flexible, and then the martensite is the one that like then it springs back into shape. I don't know. So it's something like that.
I'm an aerodynamicist. We will leave that to the material scientist. I can tell you exactly what the wings are supposed to do, but how they do it is up to them.
Yeah.
But what is interesting is that they are doing this during flight, and they are having flight tests for it, but they are doing it with a drone at this stage.
Yeah, that's one thing that I thought was really cool about this. So, and it's not like a small drone. They're like pretty big remote controlled planes. So they look just like normal kind of, like if you were to look at it from a distance, you'd think it was a normal sized plane, but it's actually a kind of smaller version of a plane. And so I was interested to see what the largest remote control plane is in the world. And so it turns out that there's a guy who built a 1/13th scale Boeing 747 with four 14 kilogram thrust jet engines. And it has a wingspan of 5 meters, and it's fully remote controlled. Sorry? And this thing is incredible.
Is this like a guy that works for Boeing? Could you make it sound like it's a guy maybe in his back shed that decided he was going to sort of build himself?
Yeah, no, it's just some like model enthusiast from Germany. Excellent. Well, at least the place they were flying in was in Germany. So yeah. I don't know if he's from Germany or not. But yeah, we'll put a link in the...
Yeah, I want to see that.
In the description for the podcast for it. And yeah, and all you people watching, definitely go and find that on YouTube. It's incredible. Yeah, he does like kind of flybys. And he's standing there like kind of controlling it. And then it's like flying past, like really not that far away from him. Thinking, well, firstly, I wouldn't want to be the one controlling it because it must cost an absolute fortune. You do not want to be the person who crashes it.
Who crashes that, yeah. So yeah, I guess it makes sense that they're testing this using autonomous test aircraft, given that it's still a fairly new... Well, you said it's been around for a while, the shape memory alloy, but the kind of application, the specific application is quite new.
Yes, the applications for it is quite exciting, especially in terms of flow control, because ideally you want to keep the boundary layer attached to your flying object for as long as possible. So if you can change the physical shape based on the conditions that you sense, it just gives us so much more room to play with. But Nick also had a very interesting factor around the shape memory alloys.
Did I?
Did you?
No pressure now.
The one with the bones.
Oh yeah, well yeah, you can so you can use shape memory alloys to help heal if you've broken your bone basically. I don't know why I did that, that's a really horrible thing to do. So yeah, if you've broken your bone, then you can use shape memory alloy because when it's cold outside, it has a particular shape, and then you have some surgery, they put it around the broken bone, and then as it heats up inside your body with your own body's heat, it starts to contract around and like basically hold the bone in place as it's healing. I don't know if they then just leave it in there or not. I didn't read that far.
I just find it really exciting that for something like this, there is such a variety of things that you can do with it.
Yeah.
That you can use it for anything from aircraft to control surfaces.
I couldn't believe how what the deflections they were able to get. Again, I'm doing the bird thing, but like there was like 70 degrees with the shape minimum, because when you think about an alloy or a metal, you think maybe with temperature you might be able to bend it a little bit, but you know they were talking about. You know, 70 degree deflections are quite high.
Quite high angles, and the idea is now to extend it so that you can do it in both directions.
Yeah.
Because at this stage, you can only do it in one direction.
And then they have to glide and then turn the wings around.
Because that's what I kind of read, that there's this one-way effect where you have to still apply a force when it's cool to deform it, and then you apply temperature and it moves into a certain shape.
Yeah.
Or the two-way effect, where it essentially remembers two different forms.
Yeah.
But I was also reading that there are also magnetic shape memory alloys. So by applying a magnetic field, you can achieve the same effect that you would achieve by heating.
Okay, well, we can move on to our final interesting fact, and that is cray.
Yeah, so I've kind of named my fact or interesting thing the geological side of the moon as a kind of poorly veiled attempt to link it to Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon seminal album.
Yeah.
which I'd like to talk about, but I'm not going to. So all of this is kind of because I want to kind of talk a little bit about the moon.
Yeah.
And
because there's some stuff happened on the moon this month, right?
And I'm going to kind of say it on the dark side of the moon, and there's going to be like someone's going to press a buzzer somewhere and go, no, wrong. Because the dark side of the moon isn't actually the dark side of the moon.
Right.
It's just the far side of the moon that we never see from Earth.
Yeah, it's kind of, I guess it's just as well lit as the other side of the moon, more or less.
Yes. So yeah, I mean, a couple of months ago now, was it maybe the end of last year, the Chinese landed rover on
I think they launched it. They launched it in December, and then it was kind of chilling out over Christmas, flying over there, and then January it landed.
It was
early
ready.
January, yeah.
Yeah, so this is kind of the second Chinese rover to land on the moon. The first one to go to the far side.
Yeah.
It's the fourth in their kind of grand plan of missions to the moon. And the kind of one of the reasons that I'm kind of interested in it is there's a sort of tenuous link to link to the research that I do. So one of the reasons of putting the lander and the rover onto the moon is basically so we can learn a bit more about the subsurface of the moon.
Yeah.
And they are doing that using an instrument called Lunar Penetrating Radar.
Right.
For which there is, unsurprisingly, an Earth equivalent called Ground Penetrating Radar.
Presumably they are actually exactly the same thing.
Pretty much exactly the same, yeah. They've just kind of, you know, swapped up that first term there to make it sound sexy and, you know, space-like.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah,
so
I mean,
why would they want to find out about the subsurface of the moon?
That's a good question. I kind of asked myself, you know, why are we still kind of interested in the moon in general? And I think one reason is purely just sort of scientific sort of exploration and knowledge.
I mean, we still have to work out if it's made of cheese, right?
Yeah, can we do that with an LPR?
Surely the surely that can tell us how many, like, what's the whole distribution.
I can do I'll do a simulation with cheese.
Yeah.
To test that effect.
Your mass is going to be off. That's a problem.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess the other thing is, I suppose we can kind of, if we understand more about the moon, we can probably still have understand, you know, the history of our solar system.
Mm.
But I mean, what's ideal for using GPR or LPR on the moon is that what we know about the subsurface is it's really, really dry and it's not very conductive. So that means that you can, the radio waves that you send into the subsurface from the GPR penetrate really far. So it means you can kind of, you can image quite far into the kind of subsurface of the moon.
Okay.
Which is pretty effective.
I mean, just to briefly go back to the, there is actually a tenuous link to even more tenuous link to dark side of the moon. Turns out that the rocket that they used to get the lander up into orbit is called the Long March, and Dark Side of the Moon was released on the 1st of March, 19... Don't know. I've forgotten that one.
I feel like, yeah, I should have that fact to hand. yeah, that's quite tenuous, but yeah, I like it.
Slightly less tenuous. I'm not talking about Pink Floyd anymore. So one of the things I thought was really cool about this mission is that they're using, they had to use a, because it's on the far side of the moon, which obviously we don't have any direct line of sight to from Earth, they had to use a second satellite in orbit to relay all of the information back to us, which they've never had to do before on a lunar mission. Usually, you know, they're all the astronauts are just kind of, you know, if you can see the moon, you can kind of see where they've landed.
Yeah.
In fact, and if you want to kind of do something cool, then so you know Google Earth.
Yeah.
So there is something, it's like a kind of boring version of Google Earth called Google Moon, and and you can you just Google Moon, and they've got all of the landing sites on there.
Please don't. Can you drop your little astronaut onto the?
Yeah, you can't do street view. But it's really cool. I say really cool. I find it really cool. You can go on there and you can see where they've landed. It's got like kind of navigation points, and you can see where they've walked. And some of them, they've overlaid with like the kind of general moon image, some kind of higher resolution images, and you can make out the tracks in the. In the surface where like the rover went over and stuff like that.
Cool.
Yeah. I don't know if that's evidence enough for moon.
Oh, the conspiracists. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably faked.
there is a I think it was a movie I can't remember what it was. There was a movie released, I think it was the early 90s, called The Dark Side of the Moon, which was a kind of hoax conspiracy moon landing film. Which was supposed to be like a kind of take the mick out of people who didn't think that the moon landings happened. And then some of them, like even now, still think, like kind of reference that movie as reasons for, conspiracy theory reasons for them not being a moon landing. And it was just completely tongue in cheek. Yeah.
I have a question for you. So... your research, how does that apply to asteroids and mining asteroids? Will you be using the same technology? Because we know that one of the future occupations is going to be asteroid miner. How does that apply?
Yeah, see, I didn't really know anything about this until last year when I was kind of contacted because part of my research is developing a simulation tool to simulate how this, you know, this radar would work, mainly on Earth at the moment. I'd never really envisaged any other application. I was contacted by somebody who is kind of interested in what it would take to be able to look, you know, image inside asteroids to know if there are, you know, minerals or water or whatever that could be mined. In this case, it was to do with the concept of kind of being able to extract water from asteroids to then make rocket fuel so that you didn't have to carry as much into space. You could do a sort of in-space refueling of some sort. So it sounded pretty wacky, but the kind of idea that you could use GPR or LPR radio waves to do this is certainly possible. Maybe it's a new avenue that I should be pursuing. I don't know. But what was kind of amazing to me when I was looking into all this was when do you think the last kind of soft landing on the moon was prior to this latest one?
Surely, I don't know. Surely fairly recently. I don't know.
76.
Really?
Yeah.
That's ages ago.
Yeah, since then they've done what they called hard landings, where you basically just impact something into the surface of the moon.
Just shoot stuff at the moon, basically. Yeah.
But it's taken that length of time to have a soft landing on the moon and then, you know, deploy a rover.
Right. One thing they were saying, because we've not really talked about the rover itself, but they were saying actually that they had a real-time system for moving the rover, which I didn't quite understand, because obviously the moon is like
quite far.
Quite far. 840,000 kilometers, something like that.
Okay.
So the speed of light is.
Now I know this because it's 3 × 10⁸ meters per second.
So around about 1.5 seconds. Didn't sound rehearsed. It's kind of, that's the kind of light transit time. So that's the fastest that you'd be able to communicate with anything on the moon. So they can't have a real time system. So presumably someone, whoever's driving the rover, has to kind of like move it a bit and then, you know, hope the best for about 1.5 seconds, check the video again.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, like, if it's kind of like a bit tricky on the moon, so when they're maneuvering robots on Mars, so Mars is about 55 million, give or take, kilometers away. So the light transit time to Mars is just over 3 minutes. So then you're really having to like kind of hope for the best when you're moving your rover around. So like, I guess you're kind of looking, I don't know exactly how they do it, but I guess they're looking at a screen thinking, right, I want to move there.
Well, it's clearly, I mean, it's pretty tricky because prior to the most recent Chinese rover, the last one didn't complete the mission that it was supposed to complete on the moon because it got stuck.
Right.
Now, I don't know whether it got stuck, crashed, whatever, but it didn't move to its final destination. So
yeah.
Clearly all of that control and kind of presumably the terrain as well.
Well, I can just imagine someone trying to drive a Mars rover, looking at the picture saying, right, I want to move there. And then 3 minutes later, the picture coming back and it's just upside down.
Yeah.
So you mentioned soft landings. I was curious, you know, on the moon and Mars, how many times were there not so soft landings? And I was looking for one that's really out there. So the one that I found was on 10 November 1999 for the Mars Climate Orbiter. I first thought that it was a crash, but when I went to read up on it, it was not a crash. They just lost contact with it. So it is a little bit like Schrodinger's cat, except there's no way to look into the box. They lost contact with it, and what happened was there were two pieces of code that had to communicate with each other. So the part of the code that calculated the total impulse produced by the thrusters came from Lockheed Martin, and the trajectory code that determined where the probe actually was came from NASA. Now, between those two code snippets, there was an interface specification which was not followed, because the one code unit was in imperial units, while the other one was in SI units. So when the probe entered the Mars atmosphere, it was at completely the wrong altitude. And from there, they lost contact. And it either crashed or burned up, or it's somewhere out in space. But the sad thing about this is they knew this was going to happen, because some of the navigators raised their concerns when they saw something is wrong in the software, and their claims was dismissed because they did not fill in the correct forms to log their complaints.
Wow.
But the if you go and look up on this, the sheer amount of things that we crashed into the moon and into Mars and we lost in space is just amazing. I thought I was going to find a very nice consolidated list, but the the amount of money that we lost in failed missions and lives lost for space exploration is just staggering.
Well, I mean, it's maybe a topic for another podcast, but I think, you know, people are doing research now into what you can send up into space to basically collect all of the space junk that we put up there already.
Yeah, there's a really cool website you can go on which visualizes every single piece of space junk that they're currently tracking. And it's like, I mean, obviously it looks worse than it is because they've made them look big compared to the Earth, but it's like we have kind of like Saturn's rings going around the Earth, like it's that kind of bad.
Yeah.
I once read about the concept where they would take a big net and literally just, you know, like you catch fish, just take a net and swipe all of that up.
Yeah, I've heard of other ones where they shoot like satellite harpoons to like go and collect all the satellites up.
Could we not get our 2 petawatt?
Yeah. Can use the...
Would that work?
Pretty sure it would disintegrate a satellite.
I'm not sure, yeah.
Yeah, we'll just be sure to, you know, make the code snippets be in the same unit.
Yeah, as long as it's not pointing in the wrong way.
Yeah.
Okay, right, well, that's it. So, thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch with us about any of the things we've said in this podcast, you can do so by emailing us at engineers.co.uk. You can get hold of us on our Twitter handles. I'm on at nd_Martin. Craig.
I'm at Dr. Craig Warren.
Madeline.
At ml_Gombry.
Or you can go to our Facebook, that's at EngineerGK, or our Twitter at EngineerGK, same thing. And you can listen to all of our previous episodes on our website, engineers.co.uk. So that's everything. Thanks for listening and goodbye.